In the summer of 2018, Yes Theory had just reached 1 million subscribers. This had been a huge goal of ours from the beginning.
All right, it's November 4th, 2015. We're stuck in our tiny little apartment with zero money in our bank account.
And to celebrate, we decided to go to Europe and, well, hustle even more. But on this trip, Amar, Thomas, and I didn't feel like ourselves. We spent most of the time in our hotel rooms, sleeping and talking about all the things we'd like to do if we could only scrounge up enough energy. One morning, we were supposed to shoot a video inviting a random stranger to go on a trip with us, who would then invite another stranger to join her. But when we left the hotel, we realized it started to rain. And y'all know, usually, rain wouldn't have stopped us. We would have embraced the unexpected weather and set up a slip and slide or something. But that day, we were running on empty. Our hustle was parasitic, growing the business while sucking us dry. So we took a literal rain check and went back into the hotel to crash. It was around that time that we got word that there was a chance that we could meet one of our biggest idols ever.
I cannot believe how much YouTube has awakened me. I'm finding my voice. There's so much stuff I wanted to say.
Will freaking Smith. Something Thomas Amar and I were going to rally for no matter what. Earlier that year, Will had started his own YouTube channel. We were obsessed with his videos. It felt like the biggest star in the world had joined the team. Our team. So after brainstorming a million ways to collaborate, Amar came up with an idea that we thought was just ridiculous enough to catch Will's attention. We posted a video to our channel challenging Will to bungee jump out of a helicopter.
So, Will, as a man who's not afraid of robots, aliens, or zombies, let's take this shit to the next level with the most thrilling thing any of us have ever done, a helicopter bungee jump.
And then, a few days later, Will posts a video to his channel.
I got three conditions. One, we do it for charity. Two, we do it after I finish shooting my movie, because I don't want to be in breach of my movie contract. I can't be jumping out in the helicopter when I got a movie. And three, most important, non-negotiable, we do it over the Grand Canyon.
Dude.
What's happening? Dude, check Will Smith's YouTube channel!
Everyone needs to relax! Everyone needs to relax!
God, dude, no!
It was like every dream coming true. Will had been such an inspiration to us. Every late night, every missed party, every time we got down on ourselves, it was willpower that pulled us through. See what I did there?
You know, while the other guy's sleeping, I'm working. While the other guy's eating, I'm working.
And even though we were exhausted in Budapest, we thought if we could get in the same room with Will, maybe we could absorb some of his power and jump over this wall we just hit.
This is the moment we've been waiting for 3 months, and it's finally happening. So such mixed like emotions right now. I'm like trying to check.
We arrived at Will's hotel in Budapest way before we needed to, so we could set up cameras and pretend like we weren't freaking out.
We're walking up to the hotel room we're going to meet him right now.
Oh. Yeah! Finally!
Thank
What's
you.
The deal? What's the deal? Welcome to Budapest!
Thanks for making it happen.
I'm ready.
And within 5 minutes of meeting him, we were pouring our hearts out. We didn't mean to tell the guy who basically invented hustle that we were tired. We didn't want to seem like we were complaining, but the man seriously has superpowers. We could not resist telling him how drained we'd become.
We haven't taken 2 weeks without not filming.
I know,
the past 3 years. And
we
just feel like we've exhausted ourselves and kind of our creativity. We're almost becoming like parodies of ourselves. You know, we're filming stuff.
Our entire lives had been about chasing that next big idea or adventure. Then we'd turn around a video about it. And on to the next one.
You live and you do and you bang around and you get knocked and you date and you break up and you do all that. You know, you have all of those experiences. And then you need huge amounts of time to just sit with it. To just be quiet, to just be still.
When he said this, I thought I heard him wrong. The guy who was releasing blockbuster after blockbuster and just started a YouTube channel, what, for fun? Was telling us to stop?
And growth and expansion doesn't come from doing. Growth and expansion comes from relaxing and allowing it to sit in. So you have to stop.
To be honest, I didn't really know what to make of this. The thought of slowing down terrified me. And I wasn't alone. Thomas Amar and I spent years juggling content creation with side hustles. We shared a one-bedroom apartment for a while, making as many videos as we could. And we were more than willing to do it, to lose ourselves in the American dream of it all. So you'd think when Will, a creative genius who racked up 5 Golden Globe nominations, 2 Academy Award nominations, and won 4 Grammy Awards on top of building a family and a media empire, told us to take a break, we'd have listened. But Thomas Amar and I were too afraid we'd lose our edge if we took a second to breathe. So we just kept on going. Until the pandemic.
I just want to stop. I don't want to think about videos. This is like the only opportunity we'll ever get to just fully stop and reflect. And we can't waste it.
After a few weeks of staying home, doing nothing for the first time in 5 years, Amar, Thomas, and I found ourselves at the round table in the Yes House. Suddenly realizing that for the first time in a long time, we all felt pretty damn good, all things considered. And then we understood what Will was trying to tell us back in Budapest. Nothing kills a career faster than burnout. We had to rest to reset. Our value was not equivalent to how many videos we put out in a year. And that reckoning was really uncomfortable. From Headspace Studios, I'm Matt Daher.
I'm Amar Kandil.
And I'm Thomas Bragg.
This is the Yes Theory Podcast. We'll be right back after the break.
You decided to upgrade your outdoor deck, so you ordered the essentials, a power washer, a set of patio chairs, and a shiny new grill. And you used your Bank of America Cash Rewards credit card, choosing to earn 3% cash back on online shopping, or up to 5.25% as a preferred rewards member, which you put towards the cost of your most essential deck addition, a bird feeder. Apply for yours at bankofamerica.com/more rewarding.
Copyright 2020 Bank of America Corporation.
Burnout creeps in slowly and then all at once. It's like continuing to pile clothes on that heap of dirty laundry in your closet. You're playing with gravity and then one day, it's bound to topple over. We knew that we weren't alone in feeling this way. So we set up a voicemail for our listeners to share their burnout stories. And we were right. In less than an hour, we'd accumulated hundreds of messages.
Our generation isn't acknowledging burnout. We're calling it success. We're calling it productivity. We're calling it accomplishment.
And I think that has something to say about the American work ethic and the idea that you're only worthy if you're producing something.
If I'm not, quote unquote, being productive, then my anxiety ramps up.
Symptoms were just feelings of being alone. You know, you felt sad and depressed.
I'd feel lost, like I had no purpose or identity.
We're going to play a few more messages throughout the episode, but these are just a fraction of what we've heard from you. It's important to us that you know that you're not alone in possibly feeling this way too. So ask around and maybe share what you're going through to normalize the reality that we're all living in. The obsessive grind can bury the meaning, the joy, the reason you're living and working and doing and being in the first place. And so the question is not how to keep going or how to ride out the moments of burnout. The question is really, how do we prevent hitting that breaking point in the first place? How can we create a balanced lifestyle where rest and productivity are valued equally? I, like a lot of millennials, was first able to diagnose my burnout after reading Anne Helen Peterson's viral BuzzFeed article, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. She described some of the simple things I was struggling to do, like getting my oil changed, in a way that made me feel like less of a deadbeat. And last month, Anne published a great book called Can't Even, that goes even further into the crisis at hand. In the foreword, she writes, "The overarching clarity offered by this pandemic is that it's not any single generation that's broken or fucked or failed. It's the system itself."
And like, do you actually know any lazy millennials?
Not a single one.
Yeah, right?
Everybody's like, it's like almost sad. You're like, I wish I met a few that were lazy. You know?
Right. Like every millennial I know has worked as like so hard for so long. At some point, there will be a really interesting reckoning.
You are talking about something that not only I'm facing, but that every single one of my friends is facing. And I can tell you pretty much every single person that watches our videos is facing, which is the infamous burnout. For those who are new to all this, even the terminology of it all, because vocabulary in this situation is so important, I'd love for you to define two things, to define burnout and also to define millennial.
Clinically, there are psychoanalysts who have written about burnout. Its most extreme form is like you hit a breaking point and then you kind of collapse and either have to be like hospitalized or you quit your job, you drop out of society, like you really hit the wall, right? Like you actually stop. Mm-hmm. But I think the way that most people experience it is a far less acute form in which it's just like the backdrop of your everyday life. And a millennial is generally this big grouping that we think of in terms of like a time when you were born to another time when people were born.
The youngest millennials were born in 1996, and they'll turn 24 in 2020. The oldest will turn 39. And in the United States, there are now more of us than any other generation.
I think that like a lot of things in America, when we talk about a millennial, we are often talking about a white middle-class millennial. And there are so many different types of millennials, right?
Burnout may be a word that started to float around in recent years, but it's important to remember it's been around for quite a while. I mean, burnout is kind of fundamental to the myth that the harder you work, the more successful you'll be. That very myth discounts the fact that historically marginalized communities hit a wall, not by choice, but just because of their identity. If we drove ourselves to burnout while chasing our dream to make it as YouTubers, you can certainly bet that the reality gets much starker for others.
My name is Miriam, and I am from Cincinnati, Ohio. Because I am a Muslim, Egyptian, hijabi, female, I feel like I have to prove to others that I deserve a chair at the table more than the average person should have through things I choose to pursue.
Hi, my name is Leah from the Bay Area. I'm 29 years old and being a black person and working in education is hard when you have deadlines and you're hurting and like you're dealing with trauma because of things you're seeing on the news and things that's happening within your community.
I can only imagine how tough it's been to do your job when the cards are stacked against you. But now, even white millennials are starting to recognize they're fighting an unwinnable battle. The inspiration for this came from your own experience, right?
Yes, yes. I was absolutely in denial about burnout being something that I was experiencing because in my mind, I thought that burning out meant like collapsing, right? Or that doctors get burnout or journalists working in like wars, like overseas, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
People who have extreme forms of work that really put them through the ringer. I thought that's the only way that you could really get burnout. Or that if you're like, okay, I'm a little like I'm tired or I'm exhausted at work, like I'll take a vacation and then it's fixed. And I didn't realize that like my crankiness, my inability to do anything on my to-do list, like all of those things were actually manifestations of a different sort of burnout.
Mm-hmm. And was there like a critical point where you were like, this is definitely something that I have to pay attention to?
I could not bring my shoes to the cobbler. I could not mail this package that I'd been meaning to send to a friend. Mm. Like it just sat there. Like mm-hmm. I live in a place where you can park and get out of your car and wait in line for 1 minute and everyone is very nice. Like it was not hard to go to the post office, but I could not get myself to do it.
And did you initially think that it was your fault or did you immediately realize that it was something bigger?
Initially, I started researching errand paralysis, which was me trying to figure out why I couldn't get that stupid package to the post office. And as I started looking at the critique around the word adulting and like the general idea that like millennials are bad at growing up and taking responsibility and even doing simple things like, you know, at the same time that I was researching the article, it was right before the 2018 midterm election. And there was this great piece in New York Magazine where they interviewed people on why they didn't figure out how to vote. And there was this person that was like, I couldn't go to the post office. Like I couldn't do it.
Mm.
And people ragged on this guy so hard. But I was kind of like, I get it, right?
If you're kicking yourself because you still haven't registered to vote, there's no better time than now. It may be too late to cast a ballot in November, but your vote could be a deciding factor in a future race. So seriously, make that a priority. It's really important. But while you're waiting for that day to come around, take some time to recognize that putting off registration may be a signal that you're burnt out.
We personally feel unable to do these things, and that intersects with like all of these different ways in which society has made these things incredibly difficult. So like, you can't call and get your reimbursements for your therapy bills because insurance has made it so difficult. Like, it's such a labyrinthian process to get those claims processed that you run up against too much and then you just kind of push it to the side. And then that made me start thinking about, okay, well, why do I feel like it's too much? My mom used to run errands all day. Like, I just remember my mom just like in our like station wagon, just running errands around our small town. She just did it, right? I don't think she like liked it. She was just like, okay, I do this. What really led me into thinking about this as a particularly millennial focused affliction is that millennials have internalized the idea that you need to be working at all times. And so I was like, oh, okay. Like, we can't spend the time to go register to vote because we're so scared about taking time away from work. That you need to be productive at all times. If you don't, you will sink to the bottom of the economic ladder. You will fall out of the middle class. You will not, you know, achieve the dreams of your parents, and you will not be a successful human.
You probably saw the headline a few years back about how millennials can't afford to buy their own homes because we're spending too much money on avocado toast and gourmet coffee. Beyond how ridiculously oversimplified that argument is, I'd say that we don't prepare or eat meals at home because we're always working, right? Despite killing ourselves to prove our worth, other generations love to say otherwise. Here's Bureau from Minneapolis.
A lot of people say that us millennials are the generation of participation trophies. What you end up doing is overcompensating to prove people wrong. You know, we take on three jobs, we take on multiple majors, and we work way harder than we need to prove people wrong.
All of this comes from a feeling of precarity. And at the root of that is the feeling that I have no safety net. Like, I'm one paycheck away from like everything falling apart. And whether that means like getting evicted, having an illness that could bankrupt you, there are just so few safety nets left. But the feeling is I could lose everything at any moment. People are always like, oh, millennials just want socialism. And it's like, millennials want a safety net. Like, we want to stop being so terrified all the time.
We are going to take a quick break. When it comes to dealing with burnout, there's no one-stop solution for stepping back from the brink. But you've got to have at least some tools in your toolkit. And a great place to start is with Headspace. As you heard earlier this season, meditation has absolutely changed my life. It helped me start to deal with the low hum of anxiety that played under everything that I did. And to this day, it's tied with running as number one in my toolkit for dealing with anxiety. I find that on the days that I run and meditate, I'm just a healthier and happier human. But look, I'm not gonna lie. Meditation is hard and uncomfortable. Naturally, on the hard days, you just want to avoid it. Because when you first sit down and try to quiet your mind, all you realize is just how freaking loud it is in there. That's why Headspace is amazing. The app has hundreds of guided meditation sessions on everything from stress to sleep. There are SOS exercises for meltdown moments and mini meditations for busy days. There are tons of tools for helping you become more mindful. Anyways, you probably know by now that Headspace is the sponsor for this entire show. But I'd tell you all this regardless because Headspace is actually our team's favorite app. And it's an absolute game changer for becoming more present, especially when you feel the signs of burnout sneaking up on you. Start your journey towards a healthier, happy life with Headspace. Download the app today for free. You might look at Yes Theory and think we've had a lot of success by the standards of the American dream. We started from nothing, made a lot of content, and grew a passionate audience. But despite all that, Amar Thomas and I can't shake the feeling that it may all go away. When it comes down to it, Yes Theory's success is in the hands of a freaking YouTube algorithm. If an algorithm changes, then boom, a huge cut in our viewership. And I've fallen into that trap where the second the work doesn't succeed as much, or like you have a dip in whatever, your whole identity comes crashing down with it.
So like for me, if all of my life was just how well a piece did online, was just how many hits I got, like think of that roller coaster. And it is to some extent. I have to battle that all the time when there are so many things that have nothing to do necessarily with the quality of the work. Like it could have hit the news cycle in a weird moment. Facebook's algorithm could have been tinkered with. There are so many things that change the traffic. And that has nothing to do with my quality as a person. Yeah. Disarticulating that is so, so hard. Like this is the hard thing about millennials. Our identity is so intertwined with our work that when the work starts to fail, the work starts to feel hard or less fulfilling or exploited, like everything falls apart with it. This is about just a general paralysis when it comes to our ability to stop working.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, me and all my friends have struggled with absurd amounts of anxiety and mental health problems. And it's funny because we have this job where from the outside, it seems like we live the best life ever. And we go on all these adventures, do this crazy stuff. And people will email us and DM us just being like, how do I do what you're doing? How do I live this life? And I'm like, if you saw the things that like we talk about when we're really low, like you would quickly realize it's really not that different from any job that's stressful. Like it's really just truly just such a grind. And almost sometimes, like even this pandemic, you lift up your head and you're like, what is going on?
You have to change your relationship to work. Because if you feel like you have to be working all the time, you are never going to be able to authentically make that space for other people in your life. And so only when you do that, and this is again for the people who are working from home, this is even more difficult at the moment, because if you are newly working from home, you probably don't have a lot of practice with setting any sort of boundaries. But like you probably need to be working a whole lot less than you are.
For better or for worse, the pandemic shook our relationship to work. This is how it affected Shannon from South Africa.
I had been running, and all of a sudden I had to stop. And it was almost this forced burnout where I suddenly had to realize that there was more to life than what I was doing. There was more to life than running the race. Despite having purpose and despite feeling a fulfillment of productivity, I just didn't have passion left over for anything that mattered. I didn't have love left over for people around me. I didn't have anything left when the day finished.
We are all crabs in a barrel, and we are all trying to survive and get out, but we don't even know what out looks like. You almost feel like you're just crawling and climbing and scratching, and you don't actually even know what the objective is. Like ultimately, deep down, it's to be quote unquote happy, but you don't even know what that means anymore.
Yeah. And I think even that metaphor of crabs in a barrel, when you're working so hard and all you're thinking about is your personal success, like that's, sorry to like sound like a Marxist, but like that's what capitalism does to you. That's what precarity does to you, is it makes it so that you are so focused on individual survival, because that survival is in question, that you are willing to step on anyone in order to just make it out of the barrel. Whereas if you're less terrified all the time, you're like, what if we all like formed a little crab pile and like worked to get everyone out of the barrel, right? But that takes even just 1 second of being able to pause and think about like, oh, if we all get out, then we'll all be better together, right? Instead of just always just being kind of maniacally focused on the self.
Yeah. It's also interesting because I have a friend who is 32 years old and became this incredibly successful entrepreneur. He sold his company for like $100 million. And I was hanging out with him and we were talking and he was like, I'm so depressed. He was like, I don't even know what my purpose is anymore. Like I've tried so hard to get to this point, got it. And now I'm like, what do I do? There's this like objective that you're going to get it. You have to work so hard. You burn yourself out to get it. Once you get it, you're like, this is it. This is all we've been fighting for?
You're like, oh, I get upgraded to first class. Like, is that what I was fighting all this time for?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is he was like, don't get me wrong, the money's amazing. He's like, to never have to worry about money again is genuinely a relief. But he's like, the problem is money and survival was the objective all along. So I've built my life around it that I don't even know how to operate without that objective.
And this is so important, right? Because like, if your entire life from adolescence is focused on turning yourself into a work robot, there is no time to cultivate a sense of inner self in any capacity. Like my partner, who is more of a prime millennial, so he like graduated in 2005, so he doesn't know what his tastes are. It's taken him like the last 5 years to be like, what do I actually like? I've never had a chance to really think about like, what do I want to do with my time? If I wasn't trying to always think about how I could funnel something into making myself a better worker, what would I do? And so I think something like the case of your friend, he was so focused on work, like that became who he was. You take that away, there's nothing left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my God, what your partner is going through is literally identical to what I've been going through. For so long, I've operated on the idea like I need to build this thing with my friends until it succeeds and I can make sure mom and dad are okay, can do all this. And then we've gotten to this point where we've gotten to these places, but now I question everything. I don't even know who is Matt and what is Matt like. I went to the golf driving range and I was hitting golf balls. And in between swings, I remember pausing and thinking to myself, like, am I doing this because mom always wanted me to play golf, or am I doing this because I actually like golf? Like, right. I can't even tell the difference anymore. It's impossible to know what direction you want to point your life in when you're unsure of what you like to do, who you actually are outside of the typical 9-to-5. Anne's partner and I are not the only people dealing with this.
Hey, I'm Chris. I'm from Utah and I'm 19. I do photography whenever basically I'm not working. It's my side income as well as one of my main passions. And I've had times in my life where literally the thought of photography would make me sick. Just like a complete disinterest of your passion entirely, which was really devastating, honestly.
My name is Brooke and I am 23. And I live in Denver, Colorado. So like, I love to crochet. I'm 23 and I love to crochet. I also like to skateboard, which are both very random things. But I begin to lose these parts of myself that are curious for things that are slow and things that take time and practice because I'm trying to run up a ladder or run up a mountain of success and of work.
And I think that having all of those wide spaces of unproductive, quote unquote, time allows you to figure out, oh, this is who I am. Again, when we think about like just being so exhausted, so many people have said to me, like, I love reading books. I love reading fiction. You know, I have all of these books on my nightstand, but I get into bed at night and I stare at the book and then I scroll my Instagram feed.
By the way, my therapist literally told me to stop reading books because it was turning into just another way to be productive. Moving on.
And I think one of the things that social media does is provide that very easy alternative to the thing that we might otherwise actually really want to do.
Yeah. And it definitely exacerbates it in so many ways. When you look at all these profiles of people and what they're posting, and they seem like they've got the balance. And you're like, how are they figuring it out? But I can't seem to understand how to even, like you're saying, go to the post office. Like that feels hard, but this person seems like they're doing everything perfectly.
Sometimes at night I'll look at my own Instagram profile, and I think what it does is it like tells me a story of myself that I want to believe.
Yeah.
Right? That I am a balanced person, that I don't work all the time, that I spend all my time outdoors. So I think that so many of us try to tell a story of the balance we crave through our Instagrams.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to do that in some ways, right? You can always put experiences or like new recipes or a picture of your dog or your kid or whatever.
Instagram makes it easy to take refuge there. We think of it as a leisurely activity even when we'd rather be elsewhere, deep in a book, talking with a friend, staring into space. We all know that Instagram, like any other social media platform, isn't real. It's a utopic version of the life we want ourselves and others to believe that we're living. But that doesn't stop us from curating our squares, thinking about how often to upload or how much photo editing is acceptable and how much is too obvious. We're torn between being present and thinking about how to best present an experience online. Almost 8 months ago, I had taken a photo with my granddad, who I'm really close with. I was over there for Christmas. And it was just me, like, just my hand over his shoulder, and we were looking so happy. And my cousin took the photo, and I looked at it. Like, instant thought in my head was, will this get a lot of likes? It's like, this is a photo of me and my grandfather.
It is one of many ways that we try to take a moment of real life, an experience, like an actual thing that we are doing that is not work, and we turn it into another way of like producing work in some way, like because mm-hmm. we are producing ourselves for other people's consumption in that moment.
The internet isn't solely to blame for a burnout, but it certainly doesn't make our lives easier. Instead of recognizing social media as a contributor to our burnout, we blame ourselves instead. We get caught up in the impossible expectations that have been set for us. So how do we get off the hamster wheel? People give you like a step-by-step process on how to get out of it, but you've done the opposite, which I think is amazing. It's like, to be honest, coming up with solutions, you're adding to the problem. Giving me more things to do is going to make me feel worse for not doing them.
First of all, I think that like it's so individual, but then the actual fix is actually incredibly global. And that's fix capitalism or get rid of it. Mm-hmm. Fix like our fixation on productivity, specifically in America, fix our relationship with work. And that has incredible effects all the way down.
A friend of mine has this joke where anytime I have like a thing that I want to do or an idea, he says, amazing, let's monetize it. He makes fun of us because we've monetized essentially doing what we love. It's like the Steve Jobs thing, right? That whole speech about how you have to find your passion, and if you haven't found it, then don't settle. What is your opinion on doing what you love?
This is a really hard one because anyone who is, you know, in the position of doing what they love and are getting paid adequately for it, like, good, great, fantastic. Although there's a lot of downsides to doing what you love. One of the things is that if your leisure time doing what you love is your job, then it's hard to make time for anything that's not that, right? Like there's that phrase, do what you love and you won't work another day for the rest of your life, or you'll just be working all of the time. The other thing is that oftentimes doing what you love and feeling very passionate about it makes you much more vulnerable to exploitation. So that's why when we look at a lot of these jobs that are, you know, passion jobs, do what you love jobs, from teaching to writing, oftentimes they are, you know, the most exploited, the least valued workers mm-hmm. in our society. And that's really, really hard.
So do you think the expectation should change? Like, should you aim to not necessarily do what you love, but just to live a more fulfilling life where there's balance and leisure and you do other things that you love outside of work?
Well, I think there's two sides of this, right? One is trying to fix our relationship with work and fix the American job market so that there is still a safety net if you are doing that thing. So if you're a teacher or you're a nurse's assistant or you work in elder care or you take care of two-year-olds, like all of those things, if you love it, there should be health insurance for you. There should be things that make it so that you are not struggling just to survive while doing this important work that you also love. And then the other thing is there's a lot of fetishization right now about people who have jobs that are lovable jobs are living good lives, right? Like that all those other jobs are like boring and bad jobs. But, you know, a job is something that makes it possible for you to live the rest of your life. Like we don't live to work. And so how can you find that line? Maybe you are doing something that is really enjoyable, but like Maybe you're just doing something that like is just 8 hours of your daily identity. And there are so many other parts of who you are. And those parts don't have to necessarily be monetized. They can just be for you.
It's affirming to know that my burnout isn't a reflection of my own insufficiency. Getting takeout or leaving an email unopened for weeks is not because I'm lazy. Those are symptoms of a much larger societal illness, one that prioritizes money and success over our collective well-being. In order to break out from the optimization machine, we need to remember that we're so much more than what we do. As Anne Helen Peterson said, we need to prioritize the parts of ourselves that are just for us. So, our challenge for you this week is to think about something you genuinely love to do that isn't aligned with productivity. Get in touch with what makes you, you, whether that's crocheting or photography. And in case you were like me and you couldn't imagine any outlet that wasn't fruitful, here's some advice from one of our listeners, Rachel from Boston.
I really need to take more time to spend time with people around me and not be afraid to have a day where I don't do anything. And I think everyone deserves a day in sweatpants. I think it's the most important to take care of yourself first.
Here's how you do it. Set your phone on airplane mode and take it easy. This week, I'm going to encourage you to resist the urge to tell anybody about it. What I get up to, I watch The Last Dance on Netflix because it brought me closer to my memories of playing basketball, which is pretty much off limits nowadays because of my weak ankles. I know, we millennials are getting old. Setting time aside to watch a documentary doesn't mean that I necessarily broke the productivity cycle. Watching Michael Jordan in action immediately motivated me to take on the next challenge, but at least now, I'm conscious of that. I'm your host for this episode, Matt Daher, but I would not be here without my friends Thomas Bragg and Amar Kandil. But more importantly, Yes Theory would not be anything without our Yes Fam. Thanks so much for calling in with your burnout stories. We're cheering you on as you rebel against the productivity cycle. This episode was produced by Joey Folks and Juliette Luini. It was edited by Joey Fishground. Dan Kroll sound designed and mixed it right up. The Yes Theory podcast is produced by Kate Ward for One Day Entertainment. The executive producers are Leah Sutherland, Morgan Seltzer, and Sam Rogaway from Headspace Studios.